One of the best things about the 21st century has been the variety of creative ways radio has evolved.
Really? That's one of the best things? It's not been the best century, then.
It's been slim. But the legacy of Marconi is in good hands with Alex Lefchik and the Midweek Drivettes. So we got that going for us.
Which is nice.
Breaking in, making a living, and making a life in the fabulous trenches of show business. Probably one of the best books you could wish to actually encounter in the 21st century about the acting profession. I'm, of course, speaking of Working Actor. And more than that, we've actually got the awesome author of Working Actor with us on the production today. It's the fabulous David Dean Bottrell. Welcome to the show, sir.
Thank you, Alex. It's a great pleasure to be here.
Genuine delight. And as I say, just working through Working Actor, some really great lines from all sorts of folk there. Particularly, I love the way when you actually have the introduction, why you wrote this book. And it all goes back to this notion of, hang on, you've had over 35 years experience in this business. You're a success, not on the fringe. Amazing.
Yes. This is not a secret. Everybody who works in show business deals with this at some point. But it's unfortunate that in our business, being successful for some reason seems to mean being famous. And actually there's an entire
not everybody can be Meghan Markle.
Right. there's an army of people out there who, you know, have been doing this for years and years and years and led very happy, successful, you know, middle-class lives. And I wanted to write about that. I wanted to write about being a middle-class actor and what a great life that can be. And yes, it'd be wonderful to have lots of money, I suppose, and have lots of fame, but there are also a lot of problems that come with that. But when you're in the middle, as a lot of us are, you can have quite a lovely adventure. It's really can be quite a swell life, but you do need to know how to come at it and to be honest about it. You'd know what you're getting into.
Absolutely. Now, we were talking yesterday with Armin Shimerman, who, of course, you spent time with on Boston Legal in all sorts of ways. And also, you know, an actor who's very sort of skilled. We've talked about the actor as a shaman. The actor is somebody who actually captures the moment, manages to reincarnate all manner of bits and pieces. These are all essential parts of your craft. And I use the word deliberately. It's the craft of an actor.
Yes. Yes. First of all, Armin is terrific. And I met him originally on Boston Legal. And then for a while, I ran a science fiction one-act play festival in Los Angeles. And Armin was gracious enough to appear in a couple of shows for us. He's just fantastic. It is a craft. A lot of people get very impatient when they want to enter into this business. And talent certainly has a lot to do with it. It's very hard to be successful without talent. But a lot of people have talent, actually. And what ultimately gets you through the job part of it is having some craft. And craft, like, you know, just any kind of craft, not just acting, but anything that falls under the term craft means it has to be practiced and it has to be learned. And you need some mentorship to become good at it. You need some outside influences. It just can't all be you. You need somebody to be objective and say, you know, that's not really working. You need to think about something else or pull you over the line into the next level of skill that you might be able to achieve. So yes, I completely believe that it's a craft.
The technique that we fall back on that actually can be useful in all sorts of ways, whether you're RADA, whether you're LAMDA, whatever your sort of system has to be. We've got two wonderful fine folk, of course, with us. We mentioned Rebecca Bond. We'll come to you in a few seconds, Rebecca, but we also need to welcome another fine singer-songwriter, actually, and big fan of your good selves, David. Chloe Rose, how are you, Chloe?
Hello, I'm very good, thank you, and glad to be on the show. I'm excited to talk to David.
It's a very, very exciting time, of course, for Chloe, David, because it's only a matter of 48 hours before her latest single is released. In fact, we'll probably put it onto this show.
Wow, congratulations, Chloe.
Oh, thank you. And you too, you've done such amazing things. I'm excited to talk about the roles, you know, you've played on TV shows and the book that you've been writing about. And anyway, I'm going on, but it's a pleasure. It is a pleasure.
Thank you.
Rebecca, we'll turn to you initially. Any thoughts from yourself in terms of questions you want to put to David as an English and journalism undergraduate at the University of Lincoln?
I'd love to. Yeah, David, I was reading a bit about your earlier life and how your career started. I read that you took part in some Shakespeare, some comedies, some experimental work. I was just interested to know at what point you knew you were made for the stage. What was it that ignited that passion or that made you continue?
That's a very good question. I tell a story in the beginning of my book about which has a lot to do with, it's sort of a chapter about like, is this for you? And in it, I was in a play and I was having I was an amateur production, and across town there was a professional production. And every night as I was getting ready to go on, I would feel very jealous of the actors on the other side of town who were doing the same thing I was doing, but they were getting paid. And it all seemed so mysterious. And the gap between our little show and their show just seemed like the Grand Canyon to me. And I remember as I was, you know, complaining in my mind about that, I suddenly heard my cue and I walked out on stage at our little amateur show. And we had a very big house that night, and the show was being presented in the round. So I was able to see the audience a little better than usually I'd be able to see them in a proscenium arch. Mm-hmm. And as soon as I saw them, they all these faces turned toward me and they all smiled at one time. And I thought, it was just amazing, because I thought, I haven't even done anything yet, and they're already smiling at me. The fact that I'm willing to get up in front of them and try to entertain them has given me this sort of unearned, you know, place in their hearts all of a sudden. And I felt marvelous. I just felt marvelous all of a sudden. And I loved the show that night. I had a wonderful time. And that was the night that when I drove home from that production, I thought, if there's any way that I can make a living doing this, I want to try. I want to know if I can do it, because it is an incredible thing to connect in that way, and to feel everybody in the room experiencing the same thing at the same time. It's just magic. It's just a magic thing. And it continues to sustain me to this day.
Amazing. I love that. I love hearing about those first experiences, because I think there's always a moment when you realize that there's something that you really enjoy, and for you to have that significant moment, you'll remember that forever, and you'll be grateful that you had that experience and it took you to where you are today. So it's really nice to hear.
Thank you.
Some people, David, obviously would say that, you know, clearly life is an ongoing process. We're unfolding our manner of bits and pieces. As you say in part three of your book, keeping the door open, schedule maintenance, people who need people, negotiating relationships and so on and so forth. And of course, the relationship between an actor and the director is often fine-tuned. It's one of those sort of intangible things. As I say, we've worked with directors who are really enthusiastic, some directors who are not very nice people, some directors who are skilled folk, etc. I'm just waiting for you to say, of the sequel, where we start talking about the director. I mean, are there any directors who, in your own mind, you think, gosh, that was a really good experience working with that director?
Oh, sure. Oh, of course. Yeah. The majority of my experiences have been good with directors. And then, as you said, there are some that are somewhat less fun to work with, or there are times when you get the feeling that you were possibly their third or fourth choice for this role.
Yeah.
And then there, you know, I remember being in one show where I literally just felt, I felt like the guy was out to get me. Like, out of all the actors, I was always being picked on. And it got so bad that I actually sort of asked my fellow actors, am I imagining this? And they said, no, like, we don't know what his problem is, but clearly he's got a problem with you. And so that, you know, things like that are just, you have to get through them. And thank God for the other actors who were supportive in that point. You just get through it in some way.
Hopefully that description of the just getting through does not apply to one of our special guests on the program today, who's just about to actually poke into the whole system and was delighted when I said you're on the show. Huge fan. And indeed, he's directed you in The Lady Killers. It's Phil Linus.
Oh, my God. Phil,
it's not true that you were my third or fourth choice. Well, let's call you choice 2B. How about that?
Thank
that was
you.
As
Thank
someone you. Who had the great pleasure to direct you, I feel I am the one person authorized to tell you that I would have demanded a second line reading on "Thank you, Alex. It's great pleasure to be here," because didn't smack of authenticity, David.
Thank you, Phil. Thanks for keeping me in line here.
You never know where I'm going to show up, David. I might show up at one of your you know, story reading events at a cafe in New York. I might show up while you're making love on stage.
Anything could happen
in North Hollywood. People are shocked to hear that, but David Dean Bottrell makes love, and when he does on stage. What ensues apparently is 1 year of a global pandemic lockdown because
exactly.
It's a one-man show that David does, a fantastic one-man show called David Dean Bottrell Makes Love. And I'll bring this back for this audience later because I want to ask you a question about this that they might find very interesting.
Sure.
But I want to drill into this idea of famous just for a second because... The question to me seems to be whether or not the performer themselves identifies with being famous and therefore elevates the concept of fame as somehow important. Because David, you've had experiences, you had experience on my set where one of the crew members who has done everything, been everywhere, worked with Kirk Douglas for crying out loud, he was starstruck of you. And so you never know when you're going to be with someone whose work, where your work has touched them. And yes. I'm always amazed where when I do sometimes encounter very famous people or people I think of as very famous, they're surprised that I recognize them. And what comes through is it's just not something they're worried about.
Yes.
It's more about I like to do the work.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I mean, having been at this for so long, there are a few friends that I have, you know, that I've known for many, many decades. I knew them before they were famous that have gotten like really famous, like super famous. And then there's various levels of like sort of television fame that people arrive at. And I don't think what people really know about that from the outside, I mean, people who sort of, you know, are entering the business and thinking about that is that it's a job. And there's being an actor and then there's being famous. And being famous is a job, and it's not a job everybody really loves, because it
like
it
Meghan Markle, as I said, well,
it's a job. I mean, David talked about craft, and that's true. Again, no matter what side of the camera you're on, you'll find yourself in my position where. We've got a scene that we got to get done. It was outdoors. Everybody thought we had plenty of time, but that fireball in the sky is descending rapidly.
Right.
And it's a 3-hour setup of lights. If we don't get this done, you talk to your cinematographer. And at that moment you rely on craft. All Absolutely. Your art might be out the window at that moment, but we've got to serve a story and you Absolutely. Feel really good about getting it done. And then you watch the playback and you go, well, craft is craft. But, fame itself is, as you said, a job. It requires certain skills that I would require a craft unto itself, I would say.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's you know, I had a brief, moment of that when I was on Boston Legal. I think I was famous for about 15 minutes.
Emmy winner, but I know you hate when I say that. Largely, you hate it, in fairness, because you didn't win the Emmy. But right,
exactly.
But
exactly.
In my heart,
Emmy nominated is just as good, Phil. Emmy nominated is just as good. They got the wrong decision.
Yeah. That's very kind. I am frequently congratulated on having won that Emmy. People come up and say, I'm so glad you won the Emmy for that. So
I think because of me. I think I started that. I think... I've been doing a weekly show for 14 years, David, and pretty much once a week I talk about your great Emmy win.
It's fair to say, David, that ever since we first encountered Phil Leonis back in the set, well, 2011, Phil, you were saying then, Emmy Award winning.
It was when I was standing outside, I believe, the Curzon Soho, right, in Piccadilly and or near there, and I was holding the sign that said, we'll broadcast for food, right? And you...
Yes, yeah, yeah. I always like to work on this sort of system. I was very impressed. You talk about, obviously, the sky falling, etc., or indeed the meteor coming down, because The Sky Is Falling is indeed Chloe Rose's latest single. So a nice little plug.
Wow.
It is. Sorry, I'm getting involved now. I like the banter between you all. It's good. I just wanted to ask David, like, what's your favourite role that you've played in TV? Like, is there a specific role that you absolutely loved and why? You know, what was the experience you had in that role?
I would probably have to kind of harken back to Boston Legal because it was such an unbelievable accident. I had actually left acting and was working as a writer in Los Angeles. And I hadn't really acted in probably over 7 years. And my phone rang out of the blue. And a casting director asked me to come in and read. And I told her no. I said, I don't really do that anymore. and she talked me into it. She talked me into coming in. And it was only supposed to be a one episode role. And the I managed to make the guy who was the creator of the show, was this great genius, David E. Kelly, just an amazing American television writer, producer, who thought I was funny. And so he created this unbelievable recurring role for me on this show that was, it just was astounding where he took it. I mean, he just kept, every week I would get a script, I'd go, oh my God. And I think, Chloe, the thing that was the most amazing thing for me personally about that was I had never had a role written for me. I'd always just sort of, you know, been the guest actor, or I just kind of plugged into a play or something that I was doing, but I had never had anybody sitting at a typewriter thinking about me as they wrote and created these amazing scenes. And fortunately for me, I was also surrounded by an incredible cast of actors, like just iconic actors in that show.
Yeah.
So every week I went to work, I got to work with them on this material that had been specifically crafted for us by somebody who was magnificent at their job. So I have to say, I don't know if I'll ever have another job like that again, but that was pretty spectacular, I got to say.
I'm glad you took the job then. It's a good job.
Me too. Me too. It changed my whole life. I can tell you that.
The importance of saying yes, especially when you've actually got William Shatner on the cast. How was it? How was he to work with? I mean, you know, actually working with T.J. Hooker. I mean, that must have been a blast, surely.
Well, you know, I when I was a child, I was I remember the original Star Trek. It was on TV when I was a kid, and I loved it. And I watched it a million times in reruns, even when I was a teenager. And so he was so firmly, you know, in my head as the captain of the USS Enterprise. And the first day that I showed up on that set, and I was in the makeup trailer, and I was getting my makeup done, and suddenly I was chatting with the makeup lady, and suddenly he came in and sat down next to me in the next chair, and I couldn't speak any longer. I couldn't talk anymore because
felt the same thing about sitting next to you, David.
No, he actually didn't. He was just his regular chatty self talking to his makeup artist, and then at the very end, he got up and he leaned over and he clapped me on the shoulder and he said, "Welcome aboard." And I was so struck by it. And then of course I had to, you know, I did scenes with him later in the show and he was hilarious. He was a hilarious guy to work with. And he has been on television obviously since, you know, there was television and he is so at home in that atmosphere. And it was really great to watch him because he's not easily rattled by anything. He really does understand, the format and the artistry of that. And can deliver like that. And it was lovely to work with him. I learned a great deal. Plus, it was just fun every day that I shot with him because he was hilarious.
And of course, you could channel all those experiences into working with Phil Lynas, who also is known for patting people on the back and saying, "Let's get this show on the road."
Exactly. Exactly. You know, ironically, as soon as I saw you, the first thing I thought of is tomorrow I start a play workshop of a new play with your incredibly talented wife, Phil.
Oh, well, good.
It's that synchronicity we've worked on for years.
I naturally hoped the next line was going to be, "And there's a role that's perfect for you, Phil." But
there probably is.
But that's anyway, the next best thing. That's the next best thing.
As soon as I thought that, oh my God, I'm working with Lily on Thursday, starting on Thursday. Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. No, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, we're doing that workshop. Anyway.
We don't have enough time for me to list all the things that I've learned from and with David. But I do have a specific question because, there are a lot of acting teachers, good acting teachers, who for whatever reason don't believe that they can both teach acting and pursue acting at the same time. And I've always kind of proceeded in my own work from the assumption that we're always teaching and learning whether we're in an actual class or not. And we're called upon to teach things often that we just learned ourselves or still need to learn. So I'm wondering about this process, this unique process of writing the book. Again, the book is called...
It's called Working Actor.
Working Actor. I'm wondering, I never miss an opportunity for a plug. If in writing the book, Working Actor, if it made you a better actor through the process of writing this.
It absolutely did, because to write a book like, I'll tell you, the original title of the book, which the publishers didn't really go for, was the original title was called Overnight Sensation, How to Be Moderately Successful in Show Business in 35 Short Years.
No. It wouldn't have sold in London. That's the bottom line. I can say that. It would not have sold in London.
Well, you know, unfortunately, what they said was there's nothing in that title that's going to show up in a Google search. So we have to sort of rethink it. But I will tell you that doing it, first of all, it made me sit down and really think about whatever it was I had to offer as an artist or as a teacher. Where did that come from? And one of the things about this book that's made it, I think, kind of special, people have really enjoyed it and are respond very strongly to it, is each chapter of this book starts with a story that either I lived through or that I witnessed firsthand about some aspect of being a professional artist. And then I go on to sort of address whatever it is we're trying to talk about today. But it really made me think about where did that live in my memory and my experience as a human being. And it of course made me kind of reconnect to that first original knowledge that I had, that first moment of discovery. And I think it absolutely has made me into a better actor and reminded me to practice what I preach here and to make sure that I come at this with some amount of awe every time I do it.
Yeah.
And to not become cynical about it and to not.
Momentarily frozen there in a kind of cynical sort of way. He's back with us.
Maybe I can be cynical about the business, but I can't be cynical about it when I'm actually about to.
It's like having the wisdom of the ages imparted upon us, but we're too young. We're not quite ready yet to hear all of it.
This is true. You're just freezing momentarily there, David. Before we come back initially, I have to ask Phil, because I look at the background there, is that Fuzz Aldrin at the top there, your famous, wonderful rescue cat, obviously keeping an overview of the whole thing? That is Fuzz Aldrin. Yep. That's an oh wow from Rebecca. And I don't
know if you've
ever encountered Fuzz Aldrin, but he is a legend in so many ways.
He is such a legend and such a great actor that in reality he identifies as a she.
Yeah. Exactly. It's phenomenal. However, Rebecca, very briefly, any questions you'd like to put into the mix at present?
Yeah, I'd love to. So Phil touched a bit there on your teaching of acting, and I really wanted to talk about that because I wonder what it was that made you want to pass on your skills to other people. How did that come about that you started teaching as well?
Like almost everything else, Rebecca, that's ever happened to me, it was an accident. I was asked by SAG-AFTRA here in the States, our union, if I would teach a little workshop. And okay. I did, and it went very well. And a lot of people approached me and said, hey, would you be willing to teach like a 4-week version of that? And so I agreed. It was my first time to ever teach. And that 4-week little class, like I've never stopped teaching since I did that first. I just loved it. And it was a lovely opportunity. And I often say this, and I mean it. I think I've learned more than I've taught in all the years that I've been doing it. But the biggest thing that I would say about it is one of the best things I'd like to pass along to people. And there's a lot more to it. I mean, obviously studying acting is kind of a complicated process, but the thing that really changed my professional career was realizing what somebody wanted from me when I walked into an audition. And that they didn't really, when I used to walk into auditions, I sort of viewed it as being this, I can't even describe it, but like this sort of evaluation of me on every level. So I was always trying to prove that I was the most talented actor and I could play every emotion in the rainbow in the 2 pages of script that I had. And what I discovered was that's not what they wanted. They wanted to know if I understood what happened in this 2 pages of script. These two moments, that's what they wanted to know. Did I understand them and could I make them happen? And when I discovered that, I started to work as an actor. And all of that, all those, that wonderful performance that we're striving for, really, it's the source of it, is what is happening in these 2 pages. Like, that's the place to look. And when you look there, you find a million ideas of how to play that scene. But all of a sudden, you're of service to the story. You're moving it along. And it's wonderfully alive. It's a wonderfully living thing to be a part of that. And so consequently, very good acting usually comes from there.
I have a story about David that I need to share, though, because this puts it in a slightly different context, which is understanding how you serve those moments also gives a container to the ideas that are coming forward in you that you want to embrace. So David once told me this story about how he had been going in for a lot of auditions, booking many of them, where he was basically, as is so often the case on television, you're servicing the plot. You're getting exposition out. So it was one particular procedural show. And the material was, I think you were playing like an accountant who was being questioned about maybe some bank embezzling or whatever. But you made the decision when you went in to just say, you know what, this is the day the guy's wife left him. And because you didn't have it in you to try to make this material be anything that it wasn't. Instead, you gave yourself permission to let your character have a life outside what the audience would see. And that's breathtaking for an actor to come to, but it's also immediately recognizable for an audience. We might not know intellectually what we're seeing, but we know when we see real life come in. And so David in this audition played a character who he didn't even really fundamentally care about why the police were there. He'd just gotten worse news.
Let's just hold it there momentarily, because we've also been joined by one of our ace British actresses, Taryn Kay. Taryn, you've been listening to David, Dean Vautrell, et cetera. You've obviously had, I think, is it over 30 years experience, Taryn? Or is that, I think a little bit more? Who knows in the business?
Probably a bit more than that.
More, et cetera. So I'm going to put the two questions to you that actually David has in his book, Working Actor, here. Best thing about show business for you, Taryn?
Best thing about show business, you have to keep on your toes, have to keep alert, have to keep yourself fit. You can't let any of your skills go. You're forever having to juggle many things, and it keeps you young, I think.
Keeps you young, that's good. Yes. And worst thing about show business?
The worst thing is, I don't know what to say, really. I don't want to be negative
there
about
no,
it.
Exactly. So you can't be negative. And thank the Lord she hasn't said doing these Zoomer calls with me, which is nice.
Oh, no. And I apologise for being late. My alarm didn't go off to say we started. Sorry. Oh, silly me.
It's a time zone thing. You know, we all
know.
All things. Chloe,
I've been
best and worst thing.
Today,
best
so
thing
very excited.
Go for it, Taryn.
No, I've been swimming in the Lido. So I'm very excited because I haven't been for months. So it's wonderful to get out there.
It's because of the pandemic, David and Phil, just in case you're wondering about the excitement Taryn can bring to us just through actually having been swimming, which is very important.
Well, I appreciate that she answered the question about the worst part of show business without even answering. She just, she embodied it. The worst part of it is call times. It's you know, the arbitrary nature of call times, because we all know they call us to set and then they make us wait forever anyway. So, you know.
Chloe, what about your best thing in show business?
Oh, gosh. I just love all of it, being on stage, playing different roles. I just think sometimes as well, maybe the worst side of it is that you can be vulnerable in that you sort of bring a part of yourself into a certain role. Obviously, if it's something that you've experienced, but I just quite like doing it because you can play parts that you wouldn't usually play. And I like to play the evil characters because I'm ever so nice, but I can be evil. Evel Knievel. Not really. But yeah, I don't really have a worst part of it, really. I just think it's all fantastic. So I love all of it, really.
Must point out that Evel Knievel was actually a stunt motorcyclist. He wasn't actually a genuine evil character. It's important to actually acknowledge that. It's okay. We go with that. Phil, what's your best bit about show business?
My best bit? You know, honestly, I mean, this is going to sound Pollyanna-ish, but it's, of course, the people that you meet. I mean, the truth is you have ambitions, you have aims, you have these ideas of where you're going to get. But the most important thing about pursuing a dream, especially when that dream involves communicating with fellow human beings, is that you will come into contact with the wondrous souls that expand you. And one of those, I can honestly say, is David Dean Bottrell, who I love more than I can possibly say, and who I admire so much. And so I would throw a question to him, which is, David, your one-man show, David Dean Bottrell Makes Love, any chance that you would ever take that to Edinburgh, for example, to the Fringe Fest, or, you know, as my partner Dean Haglund did with his show many years ago, and then what ensued from that was a UK tour?
Wow. I would say, yes, there's a real possibility about it. I've been doing that show now, unbelievably. I just realized we're going into the 10th year of doing that show, which has evolved and changed many times. Over
right.
The time. And I've been away from it sometimes for years at a time. But I was actually just doing it in Los Angeles. Oh, my God. This incredible engagement where literally every show sold out and there was a waiting list. And then I finished the first week of March and I got on the plane and came back to New York and I was like, I'm going to book a theater and I'm going back in a month. And then, of course, a year later, you know, we all know what happened.
That tricky COVID-19, it has ways of actually just infiltrating all sorts of ways. I must admit, I do like the quotes that you've put in your book, Working Actor, of course, David. The best thing about show business, this is from Sarah, a recent drama school graduate. I love when we all collaborate together to create something beautiful. And Taz, a recent drama school graduate, the worst thing about show business, explaining it to other people.
That is sort of difficult.
I mean, he could have just cut out the words explaining it too, because the worst part of anything is always other people. I mean, it's also the best part.
You know, we craft this show to such an extent that I actually worked very much on how did we introduce you? How do we sort of get you as a surprise guest? How do we use a surprise guest on Zoomer? We structured it. We put it together. We were thinking about Patricia Tolman, but she's responsible for you being here, David. So that's
exactly.
We should also promote her book, because I promised that we continue to do that shamelessly.
Oh, sure.
Patricia, Pleasure Thresholds. Patricia Tolman, also there from that point of view. Well worth accessing in a whole new world. Rebecca, any sort of questions for Taryn, David, or Phil, or indeed Chloe, in these remaining moments?
Yeah, I mean, I had a question for David, if that's okay to come back to you. With your book, what was it that inspired you to sit down and get that on paper? What was the idea behind putting it all in a book and, you know, sharing your experience and your life and your career?
I had been thinking about it a little while, Rebecca, because of teaching. I have been teaching for a few years now, and I guess around a decade or so, I've also been teaching. And there's always, you know, at the end of the semester, I will start getting these emails by people asking, hey, can I take you out for a coffee? And I know what's coming, which is the question is, how do I start? How do I get going? How do you begin in this? And everybody's always a little disappointed in the answer, which is you just begin. Like you do anything you can do to begin. And then it's the path reveals itself. It's like jump and the net will appear. And I think the other thing was, I feel like most acting books, first of all, are written by people who are not really actors, you know, in terms of, and my book is not about the craft of acting. It's about the business of acting and the life that you are taking on, because absolutely nobody writes about that. Nobody has ever, to my knowledge, written about the life that you were signing up for. And so I thought, I'm going to just take a swing at explaining everything I know about going into this, not only as a business, but as a life, because they are very much intertwined. And so I just felt like it had not been done before. And I decided to take a swing at it. And I was amazed that Random House picked me up and decided to do the book. And so far, I am so deeply touched by the responses to the book. I really am.
It's an excellent book.
It seems like it's
Yeah,
yeah.
Working
I think that's
really
help people that want to go into that kind of business as well. I think not only is it an enjoyable read, but it's going to help people, as you say, it's going to give them an insight into a life that they might want to go into. So I think that's really good that you've put that out there, because as you say, there isn't a big market for that already.
One of the best things that can happen in life, and this is not just about show business, but just life in general, is when you have these moments where you're, I don't know, you're talking with somebody or you witness something and you suddenly go, oh my God, it's not just me. There are other people that feel this way. There are other people who are confused. There are other people who are angry. There are other people who are jealous. Or like when you sort of, just that moment of like connecting to the rest of the human race is wonderful. And particularly if you're trying to do something, an art form that is so deeply personal. It is one of the most personal. I mean, I guess singing is also incredibly personal as well. I'm sure that Chloe knows all about that. But certainly when you take on, you're the whole show, it's very, very, it's you got to really learn how to navigate that, because it can do a number on you if you don't know how to preserve yourself through that process.
Definitely. And I love that you put that out there as well. So,
and Taryn, we come to you because actually you are head girl, even though you were slightly tardy today, but nevertheless, you are head girl, having started these shows with me back in the 20th century, before even Phil Leonard actually joined us. So would you actually like to throw those last two questions to the team, please? In fact, let's start off with David, because he's making his debut on the Midweek Drive today. So would you like to use your own inimitable training to actually put David on the spot for those last two critical interrogatives?
Of course. David, have you had a good time?
That's an easy question. I have. I've had a wonderful time. And by the way, Taryn, pleasure to meet you. I'm so glad you could join us today.
Thank you.
Normally, I would have phrased it something along the lines of, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer for your debut, etc. But Taryn, no missing about it. Straight in there. Lots of hutzpah. Have you had a good time? Whatever.
And would you do it again?
I would.
Yes, you would.
I would do this show again.
That's all we need to know, isn't it?
Excellent. I was hoping you would ask my favorite color.
go on, white boy in there. What's your favorite color?
It's blue. It's blue.
Oh, okay.
When he's shopping for me.
Oh. Oh, that's good. Do I now ask Rebecca and Chloe? And
you do, Taryn. Yes.
Yes, Rebecca. Have you had a good time too?
I've had a wonderful time. Yes. Always. Thank you.
Excellent. And you'll definitely be back again, won't you?
I will, always.
Right. And over to Chloe.
It's been lovely. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. Excellent. and you'll be back again too, won't you?
Definitely. Definitely.
Fabulous. And I'm sorry, I don't know your name.
Phil Leonis.
Phil.
Director extraordinaire, director of The Lady Killers, which also stars David Dean Bottrell.
Right, author of Working Actor.
Indeed, yep. Breaking in, fabulous. Making a living and making a life in the fabulous trenches of show business.
That is terrific. And have you enjoyed yourself?
Taryn, not only have I enjoyed myself, but I'm going to jump ahead to the next question and say I certainly, fingers crossed, look forward to enjoying myself again at some point in the future.
Oh, that's lovely. There we go. Everybody's had a wonderful time. So that's all
well,
good.
Taryn, we salute you. Take care. We're going to wrap up now with Chloe's single, which is released, of course, on April the 1st. It's Not a Fool. It's Not The Sky Is Falling. It is The Sky Is Falling. Chloe, would you like to introduce us for us, please?
It is Sky Is Falling.
Oh.
Cause we're waiting for the world to end. What reflection do you see? 'Cause we're waiting for the storm to end. Wonder if it's all pretend. Hush, I tell you, when the sky is falling down, I'll see this through. When there's no one else around, whatever happens, we could go.
Step by step, slowly but surely, we seem to actually be heading out of the pandemic scenario. But be very careful. Be very careful. Still, that's the message that's coming across. And to talk about why the hands, face, space, and indeed fresh air aspect is still critical, we're delighted to welcome our awesome individual, Dr. Helen Lawal. How are you, Helen?
Hello, I'm very well. Good to be here.
Good. So, Helen, I mean, clearly this particular message, which is again receiving a lot of national coverage in terms of the way in which we can hopefully sort of move to some kind of new normality. It's still very important that we realise that you can't all gather together for indoor parties or raves, or if you do, you are literally taking your life in your own hands.
Yeah, no indoor raves just quite yet, I think. I think we've still got a way to go till we're doing that. But absolutely, today marks the beginning of the easing of the restrictions, and lots to be happy about. We can now socialise outdoors with people, with friends and family. So the key here is we can socialise, whereas before we could only really meet for exercise. And we're permitted to meet in groups of up to six from different households, or for two households to come together. And we can do this in public settings, parks, making the most of the lovely weather, and back gardens as well.
Now, very much the message is let's take this next step safely. That is the sort of line forward from that point of view. And despite the sort of temptations to do otherwise, it is important to obviously ensure that the spread of COVID-19 is still reduced markedly.
Yeah, still really important. Let's not get too giddy too soon and spoil it. I think if we can really stick to the hands, face, space now, still remembering those basic habits which have got us this far, and remembering to only socialise outdoors, that is going to mean that we can head towards phase three, and we really want to move forwards. We don't want to be going backwards now after waiting so long, in a really long winter. So let's make the most of the spring weather, but do it safely. And even if we're socialising outdoors, it's really important to keep that 2 metres distance. And the reason that's so important is because we know the closer we are to individuals, the more likely we are to become infected.
Now, obviously, we also see cases rising in Europe. We see Paris in a state of nigh on panic as well from that point of view. So again, it is significant that clearly there are also the wonderful sort of notion of new variants of COVID-19. That all needs to be taken into account in terms of the way things are going, even if, of course, you've had your vaccination.
Yeah, I mean, at the moment, it's looking good in terms of the vaccinations protecting us. But I think if we can do what we can to reduce the transmission, regardless of new variants or not, then that is what is going to keep us safe. And I think being able to be outdoors with people is a pretty big step, you know. Groups of six, that's quite a decent number. And actually, I think we need to just really feel grateful that we can now do that and not get too carried away in the other direction. And as we move towards restrictions easing further, it's going to be really important to remember that letting fresh air indoors as well is equally important. And even now, if we've got workmen or carers or people we're bubbled with coming into the home, opening the windows every couple of hours for 10, 15 minutes can really help to circulate that fresh air in, which helps dilute the potential infectious particles of COVID-19 that might be lingering in the home. And that's the same reason that outdoors is safer, is because the infectious particles are diluted in the air and the wind helps to circulate them away.
Absolutely. Hands, face, space and fresh air. Now, we approach the spring bank holiday where many people might be thinking, oh, we'll go into DIY or we'll go to the coast and do various other bits and pieces. Again, is it going to be a case of caution, not necessarily flooding to the seaside or indeed inland to the country to actually make the best of what might be, as I say, reasonable weather?
Yeah, I think it's important to remember, really, that, you know, one in three people who are infectious and are currently infected with the COVID-19 don't have symptoms. So that means any one of us at any point could actually have the infection and we might feel completely well, so we might not know we do. It's important to keep that in the back of your mind when you're heading out. And what I would say to people is just remain cautious. And if you're approaching a public place or a beach or a countryside setting and it looks overcrowded, then I would avoid that place or try and schedule your trips and meetings and social meetings when you know that it's not going to be really, really busy times. And still remember to take your mask with you, because there may be instances where you're unable to keep your 2 meters distance as you're traveling through areas, in which case you would want to pop on a mask.
Addresses, I believe, come out on stream later. Of course, the other sort of school and educational based things kind of still work on a premise of partly blended learning in universities and obviously a face to classroom as well from that point of view. Are you generally encouraged, Helen? I mean, do you think this is it? You know, finally things are getting sorted, or is it a case of, no, we're just waiting for COVID 20 and 21?
I do feel differently about it now. I do feel like there is hope. This is hopefully the beginning of the end. And the reason for that is not only because we're seeing the numbers dropping, but because we now know that a significant amount of the population have got vaccine on board. So although we're still going to see COVID-19 circulating amongst the population for many, many months, the key here is that the vaccine, we know that it reduces the risk of serious illness for individuals who do become infected. And by reducing serious illness, we're hopefully avoiding people being admitted to hospital, and we're avoiding hospitals overwhelmed and fatalities happening.
And this interview is obviously part of an ongoing public health campaign. Clearly, the actual new advert with, indeed, Hilary Jones. I think they should have actually had yourself in, Helen, firstly, in terms of the visual camera. I mean, Hilary's a nice chap and a wonderful soul, but really, you know, you should be there too. I mean, after all, you do have the awesome website, drhelenlawal.com, which is well worth accessing. But, I mean, overall, do you feel that actually we can look forward, as I say, to a bright future?
Thank you very much. I think Dr. Hilary does an absolute great job, doesn't he? And he's been around for a while.
So yeah, but he's no Helen Lawal. I'll stand by that. He's no Helen Lawal.
Yeah, I think we should be hopeful. Let's stay positive. Enjoy the spring weather, but still remain vigilant.
Dr. Helen Lawal, many thanks indeed. Keep on keeping on and have a great Easter vacation.
Thank you. You too. Take care.
There are those of us who actually would maintain that the more effort you put into something, the more chaos you cause. That means, of course, that you might be having cluttered workspaces, cluttered desks and all sorts of other areas. The flip side, of course, is the need to actually ensure that there is a more focused approach to life and indeed a more sort of restful way of actually working through the whole process. And why not actually introduce the whole notion of KonMari, to actually address this and indeed talk about the importance of digital decluttering. We're delighted to welcome a certified KonMari consultant and indeed decluttering expert, the wonderful Sue Spencer. How are you, Sue?
I'm great, thanks, Alex. Good morning.
Now, I'm seeing, Sue, actually on your particular line here, we have Sue, a life more organised, which most people would say, yes, that would be wonderful, etc. Let's see how we can actually go about it. But let's talk initially about this digital decluttering and how maybe actually within our workspaces, our workstations and so on, it does actually pay dividends to have a clear out every so often.
Oh, it definitely does. I think so many of us feel that clutter is anything that's sort of like physical usually, but realistically it's anything that gets in the way of you getting on with your everyday tasks. So you can have physical clutter in your house or digital clutter on your devices. And what it's doing, wherever it is it's causing you distractions, leads you to procrastinate because it's too hard to get on with something. And you find on digital devices in particular, if your device is cluttered or you've got too many tabs open, then it's a security issue as a first thing, but also it affects the performance of the device and it affects your performance because you flip from one thing to the other because you're so distracted with going from one task to another task. So it's really worth having a digital declutter every now and again.
Now, this research by CCleaner, a leader in system optimization software, suggested that the average UK worker has 5 internet tabs open at any one time, 10% have between 9 and 11, an additional 24% haven't emptied their internet cache in the past year, while 15% haven't cleared their browsing history or removed old apps or files. Were you shocked at this, Sue? Did you sort of think, what's going on with the nation? It's no wonder you've got the Buddhist maxim that where there is choice, there is misery. There's too much on there.
There's way too much on there. Imagine having 9 to 11 tabs open. You're just going to be flitting from one thing to another. And it's shocking, actually. There's only a third of us that are keeping on top of our laptops and our smartphones and closing things down that we don't use. Whereas actually, if you look at that CCleaner research, there's also, as we're saying, about half of people are looking after their homes in a better way. So we're much more likely to be decluttering and organizing the clutter around our homes than we are on our digital devices. But the people that do declutter their devices, 71% are feeling more organized, they're more productive, and it's, you know, they're seeing the benefits of doing it. It doesn't need to be a difficult thing to do. If you're using a product like CCleaner, you can get into a routine and it will clear your devices for you.
So what are the first steps, Sue, that you would recommend people should actually take if they're listening to this morning and say, right, okay, now I'm going to actually go to my laptop and I'm going to start decluttering from the off?
Okay, so there's some really simple things, and it's about creating a routine so it just forms a habit. The more you do it, the more likely you are to do it. So things like deleting old email accounts, old social media and internet accounts is a starting place. Stop multitasking on your things, you know, get on and do one thing and then move on to another. So close those tabs down and spend 2 minutes a week actually unsubscribing from your emails rather than just swiping and deleting them. I think we're all a little bit guilty of that, myself included. And I've noticed a difference over the last month, having deleted a few of those or unsubscribed from a few of those email accounts, that I'm, you know, in the morning, it's a lot easier to go through my emails. You know, once a month, have a look at your phone, your mobile phone, and delete any of those apps that you don't use. I think throughout lockdown, we've all been subscribing to different emails. We've all been downloading apps because they might be fun. They might keep us entertained. And now's the time just to get rid of anything that you're not using. And if you're like most people, you might have lots and lots of photos on your phone, Alex. So have a look at them every now and again and take out any that are blurred, that are duplicates. Think about foldering them so you can actually find the photos you're looking for. So folder them by event, folder them by months. I know some phones actually do that anyway. But if you're looking for that wedding photo from the wedding you went to pre-lockdown, if you've got it in a folder, you'll find it so much more easily.
Well, I'm speaking, Sue, as somebody who actually still uses a digital camera as opposed to a mobile phone, but that's probably because I'm just an old-fashioned guy, but what the hey. In terms of the steps, of course, of storing material, because there's always that sense, and I suppose it's sort of driven into one, oh, you don't want to delete that, you might just need it. Perhaps it's worthwhile considering storage spaces like cloud, or indeed even a go old school and actually use memory sticks to actually store your material on.
I think if you're storing stuff on the cloud, then make sure you're using a server that's recommended and it's got all the security things around it. But again, always folder things. There's no point in just sending stuff off into oblivion, if you like, without actually being able to go back and find it. It's like in your house. Whenever I work with people, I always get them to store similar items together. And it's a real KonMari thing, this. Store like with like. If you can put it in a container so you can contain it, you'll be able to find it more easily when you need it, and also put it back after you've finished. It works a treat with kids, getting them to put things back if they know where things go. And it's exactly the same on your digital devices. Folder it, you'll know where to find it, and you'll be able to find it really quickly when you need it.
And in terms of KonMari, is that something that's substantially different from Feng Shui? Is it a variation on Feng Shui? What, how did we actually sort of work out the whole notion of what is KonMari?
So KonMari is a method of decluttering and organising your homes that was created by Marie Kondo, who's a Japanese organizing expert. And you may have heard of her before. She's got her own show on Netflix. She's got two or three books, and she's got
she likes show. Folding things, I believe, folding because, sheets and such like.
Yes, exactly. So it's all about, it's not all about the folding, but that's the thing that that you see a lot of on Instagram. So it's about approaching decluttering in a different way. It's got a step-by-step guide to doing it. And I had an aha moment when I came across it. So my house wasn't particularly messy, but I think like most family homes, it was very full. And I read her book and I was like, that's where I'm going wrong. And the way she goes about it is, rather than decluttering by location or by room, you declutter similar items together. So we declutter by category. So if I'm looking at a wardrobe, I'd look at all my tops at the same time. And by doing that, you can see the duplication. You know, you might have had stuff stored in about three different places around your room or around your home, your house. If you pull them all together, you see for the first time how much you've got that's similar. You see that duplication and you make choices about what to keep and what to let go. But unlike normal decluttering, where you walk into a room and maybe choose the stuff to get rid of, with KonMari, we make positive choices about what to keep. The things that spark joy, which is Marie's catchphrase, if you like. And by doing that and then going on to store it, either by folding or by keeping things together in places around your home, your life just becomes more organised, hence the name of my company.
And of course, being grateful for the things that have actually sort of helped us in the past, which is always wonderful. Now, back to digital decluttering, Sue, where would you recommend people should actually go to find out further information about what we've been chatting about today?
So if you want to find out more about CCleaner, which makes keeping your devices up to speed and nice and clean, then go to www.ccleaner.com.
Sue Spencer, certified KonMari consultant and indeed decluttering expert. Huge thanks. And keep on keeping on. May your life be ever decluttered, Sue.
Thanks. Yours too, Alex. Thanks a lot.